coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. A Wilmington City Councilman is switching his party affiliation midterm.
It's one of those things that happens very gradually and then suddenly. At some point, even though there's a lot of methodical thought that I put into it, at the end of the day, you're ripping a Band-Aid off.
Councilman James Spadola joins us to explain his decision and discuss Wilmington politics. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also meet Delaware's new Teacher of the Year and delve into rising food prices and how Delawareans are coping. Plus, Arts Playlist previews First State Ballet's Halloween offering, Dracula, a Gothic Ballet of Love and Shadows. It's all next on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a First State of Mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Wilmington City Council is seeing a change in its makeup, but this one is a bit unusual. The change isn't because of a resignation or election. It's the result of a change in party affiliation. Councilman James Spadola recently announced he is switching from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. Spadola was the lone Republican on council, serving in an at-large seat reserved for the minority party. Now there are officially no GOP voices on Wilmington City Council. Earlier this week, I sat down with Spadola to discuss his decision and Wilmington City politics. So can you walk us through your decision? What prompted the switch and why now?
Sure. So it's one of those things that happens very gradually and then suddenly. It's at some point, it's like, you know, it's, even though there's a lot of methodical thought that I put into it, at the end of the day, it's, you're ripping a Band-Aid off. Just to go back in time, I think I always could have been a moderate Democrat. I happened to register as Republican a while back. But I think it probably started right in 2015, 2016, my deep aversion to Donald Trump and some of the policies, and somehow Trump 2.0 being next level bad compared to even Trump 1.0. And in addition to that, though, I think Trump 1.0, there was maybe the illusion that there was room in the party for some divergent thought and not just bending the knee. But I think what's disappointed me the most about Trump 2.0, not just in terms of tariffs or ICE or federalizing the National Guard, trying to get people fired in companies, all the big government things that I thought a party that wanted limited government would be against. But what we see in the party now, unfortunately, at the national level, I should say, is that there's no room for opposing ideas. A party, if you think about a party in the literal sense, it's 10, 15 people talking, having some conversation. Right now, the party is about one man. And it's a man that I've never liked, never voted for, never supported, and never could. So take all that into account. And then I asked myself, why would I stay Republican? And that was just a really hard question for me to answer. And other than the political convenience of my seat, and I would say, you know, granted 2020 is years away, a glide path to reelection if I ran again for the seat in 2028, that's the only reason that made sense to me, but that's not true to who I am. And, you know, so I was like, I've always, you know, I've had a good relationship with a lot of our Democratic elected officials and leadership and bounced this idea around with them. And, you know, I've been met with an overwhelming reception since I started talking about it with them seriously and since. So, yeah, I really thank all the Wilmington Democrats that have reached out. I never doubted I made the right decision, and the warmth I've felt since, you know, it's really been something.
Was there ever a consideration of just being an independent?
Yeah. So I think it's more like, why be lost in the wilderness as an independent, especially coming up with some local races in 2026. I want to be able to vote in the primaries. I want to help out some of the candidates that I think are worthy of helping. And as an independent, I just wouldn't be able to do that.
You mentioned that a lot of this has to do with the national situation and President Trump. Do you feel there's no room for moderate voices in Delaware's GOP? I'm thinking back to people like the last non-incumbent Republican to win statewide, former state treasurer Ken Simpler, or the late Mike Castle, who was a very popular moderate Republican governor, congressman in the state. Is there no room for those type of Republicans here in Delaware anymore?
Yeah, it's a good question. Unfortunately, I think the national mood, the national GOP dictates how I view the party. So yeah, so I you know, this is about the party at the national level to me. You know, the people you just mentioned, well-respected, good people, of course. R.I.P. Mike Castle. He, you know, he was a big supporter of mine. Mm-hmm. But I think he would even acknowledge it's a totally different party at the national level from 2016, 2020, and even today. So just, you know, the changes over the past few years, let alone since he exited Congress in 2010. Unfortunately, the national, you know, MAGA has the national GOP in a chokehold. That's what it is.
I want to go back to a conversation you and I had in 2018. I interviewed you when you were doing your Elected Officials of America podcast, where you were looking to kind of humanize politicians and talk about underdog stories. And in that conversation, you talked about your run for state senate in 2016. And that was in a heavily Democratic district. But you said in talking to even staunch Democratic voters during that campaign, they wanted some balance from a viable Republican Party. Do you feel like that's not the case anymore? Maybe even on either side, that people have kind of created a you're with us or against us mentality, that they'd rather gerrymander districts into safe seats than actually compete like you were talking about back in 2018, to have a real conversation and debate?
Yeah, and I think a lot of this lays at the feet of our president. I don't think that we've had a more partisan president in our times. So I think he's really helped put everybody in their corners, and it's team blue or team red. And there's very little room for nuance, very little room for conversation. And I think, I think about the mood in 2016 and 2018. I think today is, even though I think it was stark back then being a non-MAGA Republican, it's even way worse now.
So your move officially leaves city council without a Republican voice, and you alluded to this a little bit earlier. And I understand there's no legal issue with that, even though you hold an at-large seat that was reserved for the minority party. How much did that work into your thought process? Was there a lot of concern as you weighed your decision, even just the optics of what you were doing and what the result would be?
No, voters elect people, not parties. And if you look at my outperformance on the ballot relative to other statewide Republicans, it's clear that they were electing me, despite being a Republican, I should say. So, no, and, you know, in terms of, yeah, I mean, no, voters were electing me, not the party.
So you also mentioned about, you know, looking into the future and when you would be up for re-election. It sounds like you would consider running as a Democrat and trying to stay on city council in that way? Or do you have thoughts of other offices maybe that you might want to move on to? You have obviously run for state senate. You ran for state auditor at one point. Are those kind of things that are also kind of in the mix in your mind as you look at your new horizon?
I would say anything I would do in 2028 would be city focused. I was, you know, young and full of vigor in 2016, 2018, running crazy statewide races. I said in 2018, the only other statewide race I might run would be a re-election campaign. So my hat's off to anybody running statewide, but I don't think you'll catch me on a statewide ballot. Just, you know, 2028 is 3 years away. It is, you know, we've got two young kids at home. It's who knows what the landscape will look like. You know, it's not something that's really on my mind.
When you say city oriented, would mayor ever be a consideration for you?
Anything is on the table and nothing is on the table at the same time. We're not even 1 year into a first term mayor working on his term. So it's not something, you know, he's still young enough relatively speaking. And, you know, he's somebody I like and support at this point. So, you know, it's not an overriding thought in my mind.
Well, so I do want to move on to talk a little bit about city politics while we have you. And since we're talking about Mayor Carney, I'm curious how you feel about the state of council's relationship with the new mayor and how it compares to former Mayor Mike Przycki. You said you support Mayor Carney. Yeah, how do you feel the council's relationship is with this mayor just about a year into his first term?
I think the council relationship with this mayor is better than it was in the past. I think a lot of that has to do with Mayor Carney's staff. I think they're, and I don't get me wrong, I just liked and respect the Mayor Przycki's staff as well, but I think Mayor Carney's staff might be, you know, because they're new to city government as well, so they're just open to newer ideas and different ways of doing things. So I think that's been helpful, not just with my relationship with them, but really everybody who's, you know, taking a progressive approach to how you run a municipal government in terms of trying new things, tinkering with new things. So I think that's been helpful. I wouldn't say there's been any standoffs yet between council and Mayor Carney. I think, there's been no vetoes or anything. I believe he was going to veto the rent control bill if that passed council, but that was defeated, so he didn't have to. We'll see. I mean, you know, things turn on a dime, and in 2 weeks, I can tell you the relationship is 10 times worse than it was under Przycki. So,
well, with that in mind, are there some issues that you are particularly concerned about or feel need to be prioritized as council moves into the end of 2025 and into 2026?
Yeah, I think that we've had gotten a better handle on the parking situation. I still think we could do more in terms of a lot of the complaints about parking or the lack thereof in neighborhoods occurs on evenings and weekends when parking enforcement officers are not working. So that's still an ongoing conversation, but I think we've done away with a lot of the nuisance tickets that might've deterred people from coming into the city. Another passion project of mine right now is focused on litter in parks. I brought in a third party and partnering with some civic associations to help them pay to clean out, pay a third party to help clean out the parks, to supplement Parks and Rec. I was glad to successfully advocate for overtime funding for parks to work on the weekends, because that's when the parks can generally get the messiest, people, you know, hanging out there on a Friday or Saturday night. And that should subside with the colder weather, but it'll be, you know, come the spring, it'll pick back up again. And I think another, you know, so those are two issues. Another big part of this job is playing defense. So what I would view as problematic legislation, we've got legislation right now that, not by design, but through, it would incentivize humans to essentially, they wouldn't have to pay their water bill. I don't want the city to ever shut off somebody's water for non-payment. But the problem is, if you formalize that into law and you take away the biggest, the biggest carrot and stick that the city has in getting somebody to pay their water bill, that could really turn an already questionably financially stable water utility into a Flint, Michigan overnight. Not overnight, but within time. So, the stats on the water shutoffs, a lot of it is vacant houses, commercial accounts that people just aren't paying anymore. So, playing defense with that, I think with the rent control legislation that I think would have really accelerated our housing crisis in terms of really disincentivizing builders to build in the city. So one, you'd exacerbate the housing supply crisis by not building, but two, a big part of the city's revenue is based on the city wage tax, which is 1.25% of somebody's salary if they live in the city or work in the city. And there's no job growth in the city, and there's very little population growth. So the more people we can get to move into the city, you know, keep in mind in the 70s, the population of Wilmington was over 100,000. Now we're about 70,000. So we don't have to raise property tax if we have people moving into the city, so we can fund, the police, the fire department, the parks department, which handles a lot of social services in the city. So, you know, maintaining us on some good fiscal ground is also important.
I was going to say, underpinning all this is the budget. And there's a lot of worry at various levels about budgets in the upcoming years. How do you feel about Wilmington's budget status right now? And are you concerned about maybe not necessarily this upcoming year, but maybe the year after that?
Yeah. So I think the biggest, on the federal level, there's a lot of federal money that comes through the city for housing projects that flows through the Department of Real Estate. So that could be impacted. A lot of that is flow through though and goes to nonprofits to do the building. So obviously that's not good though, but it wouldn't result in, you know, firing 30 employees is my point. So not good, but I think the state has the bigger issue in terms of the Medicaid, Medicare funding. The federal, you know, coming back to why I switched, Tom, I think we're kind of tying the loop here. The uncertainty on the federal picture is you know, there's, I don't care what type of organization you're running, it's hard to have a crystal clear outlook. But I, you know, I'm still bullish on, I'm always bullish on American companies and small businesses to persevere and overcome. So, you know, we'll keep fighting.
Thanks to Wilmington City Councilman James Spadola for his time this week. Up next, we meet Delaware's 2026 Teacher of the Year, a reading specialist from the Brandywine School District. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Statewide student assessment performance has remained stagnant in the last two school years, showing a 41% reading proficiency rate across grades 3 through 8. Brandywine School District reading specialist Jenna Deleterio helps Tally Middle School students become confident readers who find connection through storytelling. She's also Delaware's 2026 Teacher of the Year, an honor announced earlier this week. Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee sat down with Deleterio to talk about being named Teacher of the Year and why it's important to get students away from instant gratification and back to books.
So the majority of my career was in elementary education as a special education teacher. I co-taught for many years in fifth grade, third grade, second grade, fourth grade, kind of all around. And about 5 years ago, I was curious about the structure of middle school. I wasn't as familiar with the schedule. I decided to move to Tally. And I taught seventh and eighth grade. I was still a special education teacher at that time. I co-taught seventh and eighth grade English language arts. And of course, we were still kind of moving out of COVID and just adjusting to being back at that time. But one of my biggest notices was this change in reading support from elementary to middle school. And so I wondered if instead of sticking to co-teaching where my influence was kind of limited to those classes, that perhaps, you know, I could move into a role that would support the whole school. And so serendipitously, the reading specialist was moving out of her position. And so I was able to be appointed into that position for the following year. So this is my fourth year doing that. And so in middle school, the reading specialist role is its own class. And so I do have five classes that I teach of intervention. They're, you know, smaller group classes, but I also support the whole school in terms of screening processes and looking at data to determine if students need some kind of a reading support outside of the classroom or what's happening within the classroom at that kind of tier one level. So just having those ongoing conversations with relevant staff members to make sure that we're serving all kids and that everyone's getting what they need for literacy.
Especially since you said that in middle school, this position turned into its own class as opposed to co-teaching. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important that reading have its own class for students who might be struggling in that department and why it's important to zoom in and really focus on reading skills?
Really, the strongest place that students are getting their academics is in the tier one general education classroom. So it's in, you know, their typical ELA class, their math class, science, social studies. So we don't want to pull them out of that. The one thing that they might not have as many elective options. However, that tends to be manageable. So I'm able to work with students in an intimate setting where I can figure out what the need is, whether it's fluency and comprehension, whether it's vocabulary and comprehension, or in some cases, it is still decoding. It is, you know, breaking up longer words. That's hard to do in a larger middle school setting when students are expected to read to learn.
How do you navigate a situation where you're working with a small group of students that are still learning to read?
It's hard, but I think we The worst thing we can do is decrease our expectations and to provide children with text that is, lower level or something. We can provide the support so that they can access the grade level text. And that's what we need to do. So yes, it's challenging. There are students who are still, learning to break down words, but we can start at the, micro level. We can start at the sentence level and have the students break down certain words and then, practice repeated reading of that particular sentence. And then we can kind of grow from there. So it's not that we're just putting the grade level text in front of the students and expecting them to read it silently on their own. That's where the teacher comes in and has to provide those supports.
How does your work connect to the state's efforts to improve low state testing scores, particularly when it comes to English language arts?
There's been a shift in terms of, the curriculum that we've utilized. So, we want to provide that strong foundation at the elementary level. At the middle school level, we also want to make sure that we are, filling in those gaps, but continuing along the continuum of services for students and providing them with what they need at the secondary level as well. So I see my role as, a continuation of what's happening at the elementary level. And I also think that because of the change in curriculum, we haven't seen the students who have experienced the new instruction and how that has, kind of trickled down to the middle school level. But I'm anxious to see how that turns out.
I also know that the state just rolled out its early literacy plan. Can you talk a little bit about, your thoughts on that and what you hope to see from that plan?
Yeah, so honestly, I have not read through the plan, but I am going to assume that it involves the science of reading. I feel like there have been components of that within the Brandywine School District for a very long time. I will say that the RTI, so the response to intervention process at the elementary level was very in place when I was there. Even just being at middle school, I have seen a decrease in the number of students who are coming to us with single syllable decoding needs. It tends to be more, the students are generally at the multisyllabic decoding and then moving into fluency and comprehension. So that's just an observation over the past couple of years that I've had as I work informing groups and looking at the data from the fifth grade teachers as we, plan for students in sixth grade. So I'm hopeful about that. I think we need to, continue looking at the needs of the students. I think we need to attend to the culture of reading and kind of those societal factors. It's very hard when students are used to kind of that dopamine hit that they're getting if they're on devices frequently, or if, reading is not part of a culture that they're used to. It's challenging. And so we have to make sure that those opportunities are there for our students. And it's almost like we're at a point, I think, in society where, we have to kind of relearn how to be bored and how to embrace that. And, bring back storytelling and make sure we're modeling that for our children. So again, I have not read the literacy plan in depth, but I did have a conversation with Secretary Martin, and she was saying that's part of it is just creating those environments of reading and enjoyment and, connecting with the families and, making sure that phonics is, of course, at a part of the early learning instruction.
Do you have any advice for either parents or kids who happen to be in the room if they're struggling to read or if they don't enjoy reading? Where do you go from there?
I think we need to get back to a place where we're using it for connection. We just had open house and I told my middle school families, like, please keep reading to your kids. They still love read alouds. There are sophisticated picture books out there, and but just creating those opportunities where they see the enjoyment of a story and they see the connection that comes out of that. We have to create that because a lot of times it is a challenge to try and convince kids that when there's not, flashy stuff in front of them, that they can still get something out of it.
I remember on the phone for years, my dad would say, pick a book. We're going to read a book. And so we read Little House on the Prairie and Island of the Blue Dolphins. So it serves this dual purpose of connection as well as literacy. Can you talk a little bit about that, the dual benefit there, and why you think that's important?
I think for several reasons. Our students need to have positive experiences so that they're more willing to engage when, you know, things get more challenging. And they also need to develop those listening comprehension skills and to be able to not have things so instantaneous or kind of presented to them in a very quick way. Sometimes comprehension or our learning takes time. And so to kind of sit in that discomfort and wait through a story, it's a skill that is important. And then, of course, the connection is going to kind of create that desire to continue to do it and engage in it.
What do you hope to do now that you've won this title?
I am excited to talk about literacy and talk about the role. You know, it's one piece, I think, of the larger puzzle. When we're looking at education, our children today are very different than our children from 10 years ago. And just being able to adapt with the times and meet the kids where they are. My kind of platform is slowing down and connecting. Sometimes the structure of the school day, 50 minutes, and then there's a bell, and then there's 50 minutes, and then they're going to the next class, and then, you know. And we can kind of get lost in that. And I think that when we slow down and really focus on the present moment and what's happening right in front of us, paying attention, giving our undivided attention to our kids, they're craving that. And that's where we notice the things, right? That's where we notice, okay, maybe they're not resisting reading because they're unable to. Maybe they're resisting it because they're upset about something or the topic is, you know, is triggering for them or something. That's when we can find that information and really address that need so that we can move forward.
Thanks to Tally Middle School Reading Specialist and Teacher of the Year, Jenna Deleterio, and our Abigail Lee for joining us on The Green this week. And stay with us. Contributor Eileen Dallarita dives into where Delawareans are getting hit hardest by rising food prices and ways they're coping with those skyrocketing costs. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Food prices remain a major concern for consumers across the country, including here in the First State. The typical trip to the grocery store can produce an eye-popping total at the register once everything in your cart is scanned and bagged up. This week, contributor Eileen Dallabrita takes a closer look at those receipts to see where consumers are getting hit hardest and some of the ways people are coping with skyrocketing prices. Her piece is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And earlier this week, I sat down with Eileen to discuss what she learned. So let's start with the items that are really seeing spikes. What are some of the staples of the average grocery list that are much more expensive now?
Well, the price of coffee is up about 21% in the past year. And part of that is because of a trifecta of calamity in Brazil: droughts, frost, and tariffs. Beef is up about 11%, and that's 11% this year, tacked on to the big hike it took last year. And eggs, which really went up during the avian flu outbreak, are still 50% higher than before the pandemic. Flour, sugar, canned fruits and veggies, and carbonated drinks have each climbed by more than 30% since the pandemic.
And you alluded to some of the issues with coffee, but what are some of the reasons for some of these other price spikes? I'm sure a lot of people assume it's just the tariffs that have been put in place recently, but as you reported, it's much more complex than that, right?
It is indeed complicated. You know, we were talking about coffee, and it's not only the weather and tariffs. We're also paying for those lower coffee prices we had been enjoying for several years. Because coffee farmers were making less money, they invested less in their operations including fertilizer. Meanwhile, fertilizer prices were going up. The ongoing war in Ukraine, the breadbasket of Eastern Europe, is also impacting prices for flour and grains.
So let's talk a little bit about how people are coping. And you note there's a few ways that, people are kind of dealing with all of this. And one of which is some of the new kids on the block to shop at. Can you tell us a little bit about who they are and how they're helping people perhaps trim their grocery bill a little bit?
Well, higher prices do present a golden opportunity for merchants who can sell for less. And so many consumers are changing their habits. And a number of shoppers tell me they have switched to Aldi, and that's the German-based discount supermarket chain that specializes in private label goods, like its own version of Chips Ahoy cookies and Fruit Loop cereals and other brands. The eggs, milk, produce, and even organic items are less expensive than other grocery stores because they have a minimalist model. Smaller stores, which does mean the selection is limited, and low overhead, like displaying goods in the cardboard cartons instead of on shelves. The Aldi just opened a store in December on Route 202 in North Wilmington and now has 10 locations statewide. And they're also expanding with a $1.1 million square foot distribution center south of Newcastle because they plan to grow even more. They're on such a tear, opening more than 225 stores across the country this year, that they will soon become the third largest supermarket chain in America.
Another way people are coping is kind of maybe a more traditional way, right? The old-fashioned bargain hunting. How much can that helps someone keep their bill in check?
Well, educating yourself on weekly promotions, making a list, and sticking to it can indeed make a difference. I get the impression that consumers are actually reading those supermarket flyers that arrive in the mail these days instead of tossing them immediately in the recycling bin. And Acme is giving senior citizens a 5% discount on Tuesdays. So you'll see a lot of people with gray hair in the stores on Tuesdays.
And I guess that's any of those type of like one-time bargains is worth taking a peek at. In addition to the stuff you see in the flyers, it is a little bit of work, but it does perhaps give you some cost savings. You also in your reporting mentioned that these high prices can affect choices as well. Are there certain things people turn to when they're trying to create cheaper meals because, hey, it's just cheaper to do things this way than having a full-on meal prep?
Well, here's a blast from the past. Sales of Hamburger Helper, priced at about $2 a box, are up 14.5%. And there's also evidence that consumers are pulling back on meats and stocking up on rice and beans.
Something to think about if you're trying to make a cheaper meal. These prices also take a toll on consumer confidence, Eileen. What do we know about the impact there?
The University of Michigan has a long-running index of consumer sentiment, and that's an important barometer of the American pocketbook. And it edged down again in October to one of the weakest readings since the 1950s. The bottom line, higher prices and weaker job prospects remain at the forefront of consumers' minds. And further, consumers say they don't expect meaningful improvement in these factors in the near future, which could take some of the jingle out of holiday shopping.
For sure, for sure. Unfortunately for many, cutting back, bargain hunting are not enough. If people need food assistance, where are some of the places they can find it here in Delaware? And what are those places seeing these days?
Well, the director of our Daily Bread, and that's a soup kitchen in Middletown, tells me that the number of people, and that includes children, who come in for meals has gone up starting in September. It's now about 240 folks a day, where before the number rarely hit 200. And the Food Bank of Delaware is broadening its reach with mobile food pantries And they serve people who don't have transportation or live in less accessible areas. And of course, a number of churches and nonprofits also operate food pantries.
And obviously, this pressure is exacerbated by some of the changes to SNAP benefit qualifications and requirements. We reported on that recently here on Delaware Public Media, and that just adds to the pressure that people have if they need food assistance. One thing I do want to mention as we wrap up is another thing that you reported on at the end of your piece that just struck me, and that is there's also issues getting food for our furry family members. What does the picture look like there?
Well, prices for pet food are climbing even faster than for people food, and it's called petflation. And it started going up in July, and it's now to the point where pet food, dog food, cat food, and also food for exotic pets is 24% above the levels in 2021. Sorry,
that,
Fluffy.
And what interests me about that, Eileen, is the fact that there had been this trend recently to like get away from kibble, right? And like fresh foods and giving your pet better food. And I wonder if this is going to wind up eating into that particular market as well, because people are going to be like, well, I can maybe afford the kibble more than I can the fresh pet food.
I think that this might be an instance of where people will just bite the bullet and spend what they have to for our precious pets.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for joining us on The Green this week. Her story on food prices in the first state and how people are coping with them is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with Arts Playlist, where we preview First State Ballet's Halloween offering, Dracula, a Gothic Ballet of Love and Shadows. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Just in time for Halloween, First State Ballet Theater returns to the stage at the Grand in Wilmington on October 25th and 26th with a new performance of Dracula. And on this edition of Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Martin Matheny is joined by First State Ballet Marketing Director Claire McGregor to discuss the show.
Dracula has been performed in so many ways, especially in film where there are dozens of retellings of that story. But this performance is based on one film in particular, a really popular cinematic version, right?
Yes. So the story, of course, comes from Bram Stoker's Gothic novel, Dracula. But the choreographer, Viktor Plotnikov, was really inspired by the cinematography from the 1992 film, Bram Stoker's Dracula, with Gary Oldman, Winona Ryder, and Keanu Reeves. So he pulled a lot of his visual inspiration for the world and the sets, and the movement comes from that movie, which is kind of fun. And, you know, it's always nice when you leave the ballet and you're still thinking about Dracula, you can go and watch the movie and kind of enjoy it through another lens.
And you mentioned Viktor Plotnikov. This is a return to the ballet for him. Talk a little bit about his previous work with the ballet and what he's got in store for this performance.
Yes. So Dracula is a ballet that's in our repertoire. We did it a couple of years ago. It's been a couple of years now. So it felt like the right time to bring it back so close to Halloween. It's, you know, seasonally perfect. And FSBT audiences are familiar with Plotnikov's movement vocabulary. We have a lot of his work in our repertoire. Last season, our opener was Romeo and Juliet, which was another one of his ballets. And with these full-length story ballets, he's very theatrical and dramatic. And so it's a great, if you've never been to the ballet before, these are great introductions to ballet because the stories are familiar, it's easy to follow, and there's this sense of drama like you would have in a play on stage that feels familiar to people.
And I kind of want to touch on that a little bit. Dracula is kind of the prototypical horror story, but there are some lighter moments and some kind of softer, tender moments as well in this, right?
Yes, and I think, it is scary. I've been like peeking in at rehearsals and you're like, "Ooh." And the dancers, have a lot of fun with that and are so captivating. But what I think gives the story some heart are the tender moments, which kind of take you by surprise. And these kind of romantic sweet moments are throughout the ballet, which make it more well-rounded and, a real story.
Take me through sort of what the dancers are doing now. When did rehearsals start, and how long does a daily rehearsal last? What are they doing as the kind of rehearsal process goes on?
Yeah, so our dancers, they have a summer break and they are back in the studios full time the second half of August. And we wrapped up our little summer series in September. We had a few outdoor mixed reps performances around the state. So that's kind of like a nice warm up to our season. So I would say Dracula rehearsals started in September, really, in earnest. And the dancers work Tuesdays through Saturdays. Every morning starts with company class, which is, the same thing the little ones are doing. Everyone is doing their pliés and tendus and battements and working their way across the floor. It's sort of not just a warm up, but also kind of the daily meditation and opportunity to dive into your technique. And then from the rest of the day through the early afternoon, the dancers are in rehearsals. So it's a mixture of some dancers are working with a coach one-on-one for solos or pas de deux, and then as we get closer to the production, there'll be more sort of full run-throughs when you try the ballet, from beginning to end. And the first full run-through happened last week or the week before, and that's when everyone's kind of huffing and puffing by the end, like, can we do it? And you see them, like, as we get closer, it really gets tightened up. They're still full of energy by the end. And that's when they can really take on the characters more and more. So it's always fun to watch them go through that process.
Now, for costume design, you're working with a costume designer out of New England. Tell me about her work and how the costumes for this show look.
Yes. So the costume designer is an artist named Sylvie Mayer, and she is a contact of Victor's because, the ballet is really his vision. And she's based in Boston, and she's the daughter of a ballet dancer. So I think that kind of gives her a sensibility about how dancers need to move and feel in the costume in order to be comfortable performing. And she really explores, what's real, what's an illusion, which couldn't be more perfect for Dracula because that's the journey, Jonathan Harker and the characters are on is like, who is this mysterious count? And like, is this really happening? You kind of can't believe it. And so the costumes really follow the ballet. There's two beautiful dresses for Lucy and Mina in these beautiful mint color and sort of pop of like salmony apricot. Which I think really speak to those characters, at least when they start the ballet, because they're these vibrant young women who are full of life and beautiful and being courted and, are engaged. And then as you move through the ballet, the costumes change and kind of reflect what happens as things take a darker turn. And they all have that, gothic feel, which comes, right from the novel.
It seems to me that designing costumes for ballet must be especially challenging because there are so many considerations in terms of just the movement and making sure that the costuming works with the choreography in terms of keeping the dancers comfortable, right?
Exactly. You don't want to lift your arm and your sleeve gets stuck, or when you're spinning, the skirt can't fly up and in your partner's face, or you can't get stuck under there for lifts. So it's really got to allow a huge range of movement, and be comfortable for them to wear, throughout the duration.
The novel Dracula takes readers all across Europe, to the UK, to Eastern Europe. I wonder from a set design perspective, how do you go about putting all of these iconic locations onto a relatively small stage?
Yeah, I think the characters help with that. because it's you know, it's funny, you've got Quincy Morris, the American cowboy, in there, you've got the lawyer from the UK, you've got the mysterious Dracula from Transylvania, and there's a great scene you know, with the Romanian townspeople, so you can see that reflected in the characters too. And the sets for this ballet are huge, and they're very dynamic and interactive. A lot of the choreography is incorporated with the sets, so the dancers are moving them and adjusting the scenes kind of as they go through the different locations, which really creates this immersive world on stage.
Are there particular moments in this ballet that you would say, yes, this is something to look out for? This is going to be a really special moment in the ballet. What should people be really tuning into when they're in the audience for this?
Well, my two favorite moments, I would say, I mean, there's so many, but a few of my favorite moments are, I love, this is just a personal favorite, I love the brides. I just think they're so fun. I love the three of them together. It's just like, you know, supernatural spook overload. They're just fabulous. And I also love Quincy Morris, the American cowboy, when he kind of leads everyone in this rousing dance, because it's such a juxtaposition to have this, you know, sort of cowboy, almost rodeo-esque ballet moment in the middle of Dracula. But it's really fun. And I also love, you know, the character of Lucy, and she has, Quincy Morris is, you know, one of the suitors vying for her hand, and she gets to kind of, she has her pick of men, really. So she's fun to watch too. There's some great choreography for her. So there, you know, there's great moments scattered throughout. It's hard to pick a few faves, but if I had to narrow it down, I think it would be those.
And then finally, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, but I want to sort of reiterate this. Dracula is a story that everybody knows, and it seems to me that makes this maybe an especially accessible entry to the world of ballet for people who may not have gone to see live dance before.
Absolutely, because, you know, there's no, you know, a lot of times with classical ballets, especially ones that have been, you know, performed a long time, the story doesn't feel, it's not familiar, you know, it takes some, you're reading your program notes and you're like, who's this person again? Like, why are they here? But with this, you know, it's pretty clear. Like, everybody has a general sense of Dracula. And like I said, the Victor's choreography is very theatrical and dramatic. So it feels a little bit more like a play than some other ballets, which I think also, helps people get right into the world, right into the story. So it's truly a great ballet if you haven't been before. And plus it's so seasonal. I think with Halloween, if you're looking for something, you know, if you're too old for trick or treating, you're not too old for Dracula. So come to the ballet and enjoy a spooky night out.
Thanks to First State Ballet Marketing Director Claire McGregor and our Martin Matheny for joining us on this edition of Arts Playlist. First State Ballet offers performances of Dracula, a Gothic ballet of love and shadows, October 25th and 26th. For tickets and more information, visit firststateballet.org. And that'll do it for this edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter there by clicking newsletters at the top of the page. And remember, The Green is also available via podcast at our website, as well as Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and the NPR and Delaware Public Media apps. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page or by emailing us at thegreen@delawarepublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make this week's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, Delaware Public Media's Abigail Lee, and Martin Matheny. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a First State of Mind.